I'm John Marty. I'm here to talk about healthcare and a proposal for healthcare reform. And I've, by way of background, I'm a member of Minnesota Senate and chair of the Senate Health Committee, which is right in the middle of a lot of, I guess, controversy is the word right now on healthcare reform. The title for this session yesterday's were our healthcare system being in quotes, is on life support. 18,000 Americans die each year because they cannot afford health care, even though many of them have insurance. Is it too much to expect all people will be given access to health care? That was the title. Yesterday we talked about the problems with health care and the consequences of it, and the values that we want in our health care system. Today I want to talk about a proposed solution, a proposal that I'm promoting because I think it's what we need to do for addressing a system in crisis. And the thought process behind this bill, it was not just, hey, what do we want to put together in a healthcare bill? But we started with the concept that we talked about yesterday about decide what your values are, what you care about, what healthcare system ought to do, and then move from there to what a healthcare system would have to do in order to meet those values. And I showed some from Isaiah, a Minnesota interfaith group that's works on issues such as this. They came up with some what we have now and what their values would mean, what we should do. And then I also showed some principles for healthcare reform that we had put together and are actually front and center of the bill we're proposing. But the legislation and the whole goal of what I think a healthcare system ought to be would be to improve health and public wellness and quality of life, just because that's the right thing to do, and that has the incidental benefit of reducing the need for health care. But when people need health care, the system should meet their medical needs. And we talked briefly yesterday about the fact that while that may seem like a tall challenge, most other industrialized nations do provide health care when people need it. It's a question of going to the doctor, going to the physical therapist, going to the dentist when you need, not debating if you can afford it, finding out if your health plan covers it, and then going. So in order, the key that I think we should be measuring any health care proposals under, I have a list of 9 health care principles that we put in there. And the goal should not be to pass, I've got a 3-year campaign, 4-year campaign to push our bill, because it's that big of a challenge. But the goal in my mind is not to pass our bill, it's to meet these principles. And I'm certainly open to any other way of getting there. I just know in Minnesota, I haven't seen any, and I haven't frankly seen any anywhere else either. And so I think we should measure all of the proposals against these principles. And I'll just quickly go through them with the ones, what they were. The first one, which is key to what we're missing now, and this is all in Minnesota terms because that's where these were prepared for, but they would apply to anywhere where you were trying a health care reform proposal. Ensure all people receive high-quality health care regardless of their income. Second one is not restrict, delay, or deny care, reduce the quality of care, hold down costs, but instead reduce costs through prevention, efficiency, reduction of bureaucracy. I think it's very important that we not put restrictions where government or insurance companies are telling people not to get care. There may be some tough issues in terms of some transplants where you can't. The expense and availability of body parts is not there, but the system should not be doing the rationing. I think individuals with their doctors should be making those choices, and some people say that won't work. I really don't think we've ever given that a shot. Other countries tend to do the same sort of thing, and people, if they're given a choice, the example I give is a living will, advanced directive, people do choose not to be resuscitated when they're dying, when they're terminally ill, and they're in pain. They usually choose not to be resuscitated, but the standard, which several people who work in hospitals said, the standard protocol is to go ahead and do it unless there's a advanced directive, and in some cases, one of the people said that they do it even if you have an advanced directive. The third one, cover all necessary care. If you're covering somebody's health care needs and their problem is dental care and you're not meeting it, you're not covering their health care. So this should be just an assumption. But what we're talking about is complete mental health services, chemical dependency treatment. A third of a million Minnesotans need chemical dependency treatment and are not getting it. Prescription drugs, medical equipment supplies, dental care, long-term care, and home care services. Fourth one, allow patients to choose their own providers, which some of us have to a varying degree. Some people have almost total choice. Some have very restricted choice of which doctors and hospitals and clinics and so on they use. I'm using the word providers here to, instead of saying doctors or nurses or chiropractors or physical therapists or pharmacists or whatever, just people who provide healthcare. It's, so think of doctors or whatever you think of when you think of healthcare people then. To be funded through premiums or other payments based on one's ability to pay, so everybody can have access. Our healthcare system now, the sicker you are, the more you're going to pay. Usually the sicker you are, the less able you are to pay. And so we think the healthcare system should be based on your ability to pay. The sixth one is it should focus on preventive care and early intervention to improve the health of everyone and to reduce costs from untreated illnesses and diseases. You could do this in many healthcare systems, including our own, but it's a very patchwork system now in terms of prevention. We don't do a good job of it. Seventh one is ensure an adequate number of qualified healthcare professionals and facilities to guarantee availability to care everywhere. There are great shortages of some medical professions in Minnesota and most other communities. We've got to do better on that. Eighth one, continue our leadership in medical education, training, research, technology. Our country's been way ahead on that over the years. Minnesota's been a leading state. You don't want to lose any of that. And finally, provide adequate and timely payment to providers. They may not all be paid the same amount they're paid now. Some may get paid more, some would be paid less. But the one thing they all deserve is to be paid for what they do and paid on a timely basis, which a lot of Minnesota state programs have not done. But these are the principles. We should keep them in mind. Maybe you can show the whole list. Okay. You should keep them in mind when looking at various proposals. And at least in Minnesota, when I look at the other proposals, our governor, the Republican governor, and Democratic legislative leadership have other proposals in mind. But when I look at their proposals or other ones, the first one, none of the other plans cover everyone. They all, well, we can cover more people. They call them universal plans sometimes. Sometimes they mandate coverage. But even the proponents, even the authors of the bills, will say that, well, you can never get more than 97% of the population. Not restrict, delay, or deny care. Most of them, no other plan that I know of touches this. Cover all necessary care, including coverage, all coverage required by law, complete mental health services, etc. The other reforms don't talk about it. Dental care, well, we talk about dental care separately, but we never talk about it as part of what a healthcare reform system would be. Allow patients to choose their own providers. A lot of health plans proposals would give people an enhanced choice. They'd have more choice of providers. They do relatively well on that. Fifth one, based on ability to pay. Ours is the only proposal in Minnesota I've seen based on ability to pay. Focus on preventive care. Some of them do a little bit of that, but it's patchwork. I think we have to have the system designed and structured in a way to focus on it. Ensure adequate number of healthcare professionals. None of the other plans do more than, well, they just don't address it. The eighth one, continuing where we are in medical training, education, research. I'd say they meet that one because they don't do anything to hurt it. And then provide timely and adequate payments. Well, no, most of them cut the funding for public programs, which providers then decline. But the whole point of what our proposal is, and I'll get into it in just a minute, is that we find a way to get these points made, all nine of them, and that we do it in a way where we got a planned system. When you talk about the adequate number of professionals, there's nobody in charge of that. We've had a critical shortage of dental professionals in Minnesota. This was a proposal to allow dental hygienists to get advanced practice, advanced study, like advanced practice nurses, so they could do simple fillings, because we've got a lot of people who just can't get dental care. The dental school dean, the dentists opposed it because it was competition, even though they weren't serving these folks. The dental school dean opposed it largely because he said he wasn't involved in the discussion of it, so he couldn't be sure it was good. And my question was, why wasn't he involved? He's got a crisis on dental care, and will they do anything to produce more dentists or more somebody else to fill in the gaps? It's not his job. He just didn't see it as his job. The university doesn't, nobody does, so it just goes the way it does. We're producing far too few general practitioners in American medicine. University of Minnesota is part of that trend, and if they will say, yeah, that's a real problem. And the faculty there will say, we gotta change it. But nobody's in charge of it, nobody's saying we're going to structure our system in a way to do that. So the important thing is to have a plan, a system for addressing all these issues. So what is our proposal? You can shut that off now. What is our proposal? We call it Minnesota Health Plan, not some fancy name. MinCare is the one we've got as a public program now. But we just figured it's simply the Minnesota Health Plan everybody's covered by. What does it do? It's a single plan that everybody would be part of. Covers all medical needs, everyone from cradle to grave, including nursing homes. It would not include any denial of coverage for pre-existing conditions. I think I mentioned yesterday that if we thought about it, every one of us would have some family member that would be denied some care the way they're expanding pre-existing conditions. Now, some health plans are even saying that some health plans have decided that women who have C-sections have a pre-existing condition, they are more at risk, and so they want to stop covering that. I mean, it's getting pretty far-fetched in terms of what is a pre-existing condition, but it's simple economics. They decide to exclude them. The coverage in our plan is fully portable. It doesn't depend where you work. It doesn't matter if you're laid off or switched jobs or retired. You're still covered. And no other plans do any of this. None of them cover everyone. It's just maybe we can plug in here, fill these people here, these farmers. Maybe we could help them with this effort, but nothing else starts with the presumption everybody's covered. And equally important to covering everyone is the focus on preventive care. The bill is structured in a way that would require enhanced public health efforts, more school nurses, where people go. You give care where people go, not where, you do it where it's convenient for people. And we focus heavily on public health and education, prevention, early intervention. I'm gonna go through a lengthy list of things, and it's my description of why I think it's good. I'm advocating for this, not just simply telling you what's in this bill. But patients would be able to see the doctors of their choice when they need care. You don't have an insurance company telling you that you can't go to your family doctor because you switch jobs, you got a new health plan. We've had a lot of doctors, general practitioners say the really frustrating thing is they're dealing with a patient and they're in the middle of a course of things and then, oops, I can't come anymore, doc, you're getting a new job and they won't let me see you. The continuity of care is all lost. It would include, and you saw the list of things that we think it ought to include, optical care, dental care, prescriptions. And for prescription drugs, there's no need to, like with the Medicare Part B, you don't have to sort through 150 some Medicare Part D plans that are available in Minnesota, 150 some. People say that that's a good thing. Congress said that was a good thing. People would have a choice. The choice is pretty meaningless because you get to choose once a year and the health plan can change what it covers and how it covers it during that year, so you're stuck with it anyhow. And just the waste of time to sort through 150 plans. There's no donut hole where you spend a certain amount and then you have no coverage till you spend several thousand more. You're covered. Patients would use the same doctors and same professionals, same hospitals and clinics as you do now. The only change in how they function is they would be paid by the one plan instead of paid by a thousand different plans. They would not be collecting, and this is controversial, they would not be collecting co-payments. They'd be billing, you come in there, do this procedure, or however the billing system is set up, and they would just bill the health plan pays the bill, that's it. You pay for the system through your premiums, not through co-pays, deductibles, and premiums, and excluded care that you pay out of your own pocket. No more headaches. This is something that's just a consequence of the bill. No headaches filling out complex forms. A couple months ago, we were in St. Cloud, Minnesota, on a hearing, and we were talking about the complexity of forms, and one guy was a retired business guy, and he said he does a lot of work filling out forms for his daughter, an adult daughter who has traumatic brain injury. And because of the several programs she's in to get the coverage for it, he says he spends countless hours filling out forms. I said, well, could you be a little more precise? I'm just curious, how many hours do you spend? I mean, how many hours a week do you think you spend on filling out paperwork? He says, there are weeks when I spend 40 hours doing it. And he's retired, he could afford to do it, but not everybody has the ability to fill out the forms, right? There are a whole lot of people fall through the cracks because of the complexity. Simply put, you're in the plan, you don't spend 20 pages of application form, you don't have to get the physical for the pre-existing conditions, it makes it much simpler. I mentioned the plan would be prohibited from restricting, delaying, or denying care. You save money other ways. And you and your doctor make the decisions on health care. To me, we have a poll in Minnesota Medical Association Journal last year published a poll of doctors, said about 65% of Minnesota physicians now support a single plan like this. Why do they support it? It's because they're sick of being told how to practice medicine. They are told, I remember 20 years ago, a doctor friend said he was treating a woman and he gave the standard treatment and it didn't work, so he was going to do something else. It was not pre-approved. He had to go get approval from the health plan. He calls him up, says he wants to do this procedure. The guy at the other end of the phone tells him, well, what about this other thing? Well, I tried that. And then he said, well, what about something else? And he said, some third proposal, he said to him, what another type of treatment? And the doctor was, well, I don't think that would be appropriate in this case, because then he stopped and thought for a minute. He said, where'd you get your medical degree? And the guy, of course, had no medical degree. He's reading a chart and some insurance company clerk, and he's filling out the thing and saying, well, you should try this, you should try this. And doctors don't feel well served or their skills being used appropriately when their judgment is substituted by somebody who's determining how much they can afford to cover. And yesterday, one of the commenters said that in their hospital, they had not that big of a hospital, they had two people who go around, it's their job full-time to tell the doctors, it was a mental health hospital, I believe she said, two people going around telling doctors, this person is not covered for more treatments than that. So the doctors know when to cut off the treatment they're providing. This bill would not only end cost-related access problems, as I mentioned, it would be structured in a way the health planning office of this would be in charge of making sure we have the professionals where we need them, so you're not denied access because there's nobody to provide the care. That would mean working with the University of Minnesota, all of our public higher education institutions, making sure we train people for the areas where there are shortages, which are as diverse as medical technologists and as precise as certain specialties. It would be funded by everyone based on ability to pay. The premiums would not go to the state government. They might be collected by a Department of Revenue, might be structured similarly to an income tax, but the premiums would go directly to the health plan. They would not go through the state treasury. State treasury would have no access to them. And because if you look at other countries, one of their problems is underspending on health care, if you believe that. But it's because political process is such that budgets go up and down, and it's real easy when to take money from it. So it's structured in such a way, a semi-public health plan that would not be accessible to the legislature and governor. And the premiums that would be paid by individuals and by businesses. There would be no co-pays, no out-of-pocket costs. It would all be covered by the premiums. Nobody would be bankrupted by medical care because it's based on ability to pay. Businesses, even though they'd be paying premiums for it, it would be far more equitable, and most businesses, certainly every business that's providing benefits, healthcare benefits to employees, would be paying less. In fact, our estimates, and we're trying to get a University of Minnesota, very expensive study on the costs of it, but we think it would be about 20% less in total healthcare spending, which means most people would be paying less. Be run by a democratically selected board, operating a semi-public agency. As I mentioned, we separated as far as we could from state government. It would be one of the things is it puts some people out of work. It takes, if you work for a health care plan, a health insurance company, they may still be administering hospitals or clinics, but they would not be serving as insurance companies anymore. There would be some loss of employment there. We have to find a way to retrain people. If that hospital where they had two people telling the doctors when to cut off care because of insurance, and all the billing clerks at that hospital, if you have them retrained to serve as nurses' aides or nurses or whatever, there are plenty of people we need in the medical care system. And the whole economy, we believe in a study that came out a couple months ago suggests that when Canada went to a single healthcare system 25, 30, 40 years ago, their economy grew by about 2% just because of that change, and they've sustained that. We think it would create more jobs. We think, though it's a very expensive plan, we think it's significantly cheaper than the money we're spending now. We're now spending, I think I mentioned yesterday, $7,000 for every person in this country on health care. How does it save money? Why do I say providing more care is cheaper? Well, first of all, you eliminate a lot of the administrative costs and paperwork costs, 31 cents on every dollar, about $2,000 per person for administrative costs. You save that not only for the health plans, where you're getting rid of that, their marketing, their administrative costs, their trying to figure out how to not pay claims because it's somebody else's responsibility. You get rid of all of that. You get rid of their underwriting costs. The idea that we're going to measure and figure out how sick you are so we know how we can charge you more, or that we have to charge you more. Get rid of all the underwriting costs. So administrative costs, we think we would slash it. You might save 15 to 20 cents on the dollar by a smooth administrative cost. You look at other countries, they have smooth systems. It works. It's a lot cheaper than what we do now. And it's not just the health plans. It's every doctor's office, every clinic. Everybody saves money in billing. You save money by using healthcare services appropriately. Routine care should not be done in an emergency room. People right now, they use the wrong kind of service at the wrong time because that's what's available to them. We would have to change that. As part of the appropriate use of healthcare services, we have wasteful capacity right now. Very expensive technologies like imaging techniques, like MRIs and CAT scans and radiation therapy clinics are some of the most expensive ones. $1 million investments in a clinic just for the equipment, and we put them in based on where somebody thinks they can make money off their investment, which means often across the street from a hospital when the hospital already has one. And this plan would be setting it up the way Minnesota started doing, where you have to get approval to put in this, and the approval is based on where the need is, not based on where somebody wants to invest. We'd save money by negotiating fair prices. The state would have more clout than Blue Cross does, more clout than any of the other health plans. They negotiate for 5 million people in Minnesota. They have great clout. You can't, if you're unfair to people, unfair to providers, they just won't practice where you're asking them to practice, which there's a great need in rural communities. If you want somebody to practice there, you may have to pay them more. If you're too tight with the money, doctors will go to other states. So you can't be unreasonable, but again, with prescription drugs, Canada spends an average of 40% less than we spend on prescription drugs, not because they subsidize them, but because they negotiate. The VA has lower prices, I believe, than Canada does for drugs. They negotiate. If we have a health plan that's negotiating for all of us, we save a lot of money in that. And you negotiate all services and so on. Focus on prevention. I mentioned there's no cost shifting. What's cost shifting? If I'm uninsured, I go to the hospital. in a sense, we're already all covered anyway, because in the emergency room, you get coverage, at least you still do now. So if, no matter how sick you are, how lacking in insurance coverage or ability to pay, you're treated. And who pays for that? Well, everybody else does. Cost shifting also occurs because one health plan negotiates a better rate, so somebody else pays more to make up for that. And the cost shifting occurs in the fact that everybody's spending so much time trying to figure out how to deny a claim. Well, maybe it's a public program. There are lots of people with mental health issues. Health care plan doesn't cover it. They don't want to cover it. And the person, they say it's the state's obligation. The state says, no, it's not. And everybody's spending all this time fighting with each other over how not to pay bills. So we avoid the cost shifting. And there are miscellaneous other savings. Our bill would prohibit direct-to-consumer marketing of pharmaceuticals. I don't watch that much TV, but when I watch the 5 or 6 o'clock news, it seems to be non-stop pharmaceutical ads. We would be focusing on saving money through limiting care decisions by doctors and patients. I mentioned earlier, by getting rid of conflicts of interest where doctors refer somebody to a facility because they have an investment in it. We'd be saving money from medical malpractice by removing all the medical expenses from the insurance liability, and you would also be reducing the jury interest in punishing insurance companies when the cost of this is all being paid by all of us. It's being paid by some of us now anyway, but it's much more transparent that way. That's what the plan basically does. I'll get into in the discussion in a few minutes the flaws people see in it, and I'll try and respond to them. But the politics. In order to do this, no state has covered every person. Nobody. Not one of 50 states ever. We're trying to do something. It's not rocket science. 1962, JFK said we would put a man on the moon by the end of the decade, and we did. That was rocket science. And it had never been done before. We'd never been more than 100 miles above the planet, and here we were going to go a quarter million miles away. But this one is not rocket science. It's been done in numerous other countries. It's done at a fraction of the cost we do with better results than we have. So I think it's doable. It's workable system. It's not something you have to figure out how to make it happen. A lot of the health plans do a lot of this stuff on their own for their own members. It's just the complexity when they're different people served by different plans at different amounts that causes some of that complexity. But it's not a popular proposal with certain industries. Pharmaceutical industry doesn't like it. Insurance industry, health plans don't like it. There are some medical providers that don't like it, though, as I mentioned, 2/3 of doctors now support it. Minnesota Nurses Association supports a plan like this. So we think we're making progress on it. Where does it stand? Well, this last year, Minnesota has created two working groups to study health care reform a year ago. We spent the last year on them. One, we created a health care access commission of the legislatures. They appointed 10 members of the legislature. I chair the health committee. I was on it. I didn't like what we did, but I was on it. Any of the chairs, committee chairs who relate to health policy or health budget were on it. That's four of us. The governor created his own transformation task force with some business folks and a handful of legislators. Somehow or another, three of the four committee chairs made it onto that one. I was excluded. I didn't take that too personally. The governor doesn't like this kind of reform. Matter of fact, he told his commission they can look at any options except this one. And the Healthcare Access Commission, the legislative one, I liked the thought of it. I had actually tried to reinstitute this commission, which had been around on and off for a number of years. I tried to do it with the charge that they be required to make recommendations on how we could deliver a plan that meets those 9 principles. Simply said, this commission is required to develop a plan during the next year that meets those principles. The leadership didn't like that idea, but they felt they had to do something, so they created the commission with the charge of making sure we had universal coverage, which is a difference, again, between insurance coverage and health care. But I would even settle for what they have, because they defined in statute, they changed the law on what we define universal coverage as meaning. It was the first clause of it. I memorized it because it was so important. It was so impressive. It would be that by 2011, every Minnesotan will have access to a full range of quality healthcare services. That means a full range includes dental. It includes the whole range of things I was seeking. It includes everyone, 100%. That was a great idea. I was pleased to be on the commission, though I didn't think they were serious about that. And it was pretty clear they weren't. The first meeting, they formed subcommittees to work on. One of the subcommittees was created to with the task of finding out how we could provide health care coverage to nursing home employees. And my concern was everybody else, if there's so many thousands of occupations, if you're going to say you're going to focus on making sure this one narrow group gets it, you're probably not looking at everybody else. And in the end, they didn't even do that. The findings of that subcommittee came back that we should spend, and we passed this into law this year, should spend $800,000, almost $1 million, studying how we could most effectively cover these nursing home employees. That's where how far we were from their goal. So we ignored the directive. I asked at the first meeting, why don't we start where we're supposed to end at the goal and work our way backwards? How do we make sure every Minnesotan has access? And then work backwards, design a system around that. They weren't very receptive to the question, so I answered it myself. It wasn't meant as a rhetorical question, but there was no answer. So I suggested that the reason we're not is because we know how expensive our healthcare system is. And if we're going to add more people to it, and we're going to cover more things, it's certainly going to bankrupt us. And the fact that it might actually be cheaper to cover people in an efficient way, in a preventive care way, that never crossed their minds, but I suggested that that's what happens. And that we're looking as models other 50 states that have also failed to do it. We should look at other countries and places where they have done it, see what we like from their proposals, work from there. But I suggested that the next thing, if they didn't like that, well then why don't they break up the commission, recognize there's philosophical divide. Some of the people who think we need a market-based approach, where healthcare is a commodity that you buy and you sell, or our approach where healthcare is a community need, it's a right, have subcommittees on each of them, and people who wanted to could work on them, put their proposals up, recognize we don't agree on this. And then both of them could put proposals up that meet the recommendations that the commission was supposed to do, and we could vote on which one we like better, or we could accept them both, make both of them as recommendations, but they didn't choose to do that. What's going to happen next? Well, we passed a bill that I think was misguided this year, but they took out most of the controversial things in it, so it basically does the what we've been trying for the last 25 years, certainly in Minnesota and the rest of the country, is we're going to try and reduce healthcare costs by somehow managing the care and how we pay for it, and we're going to try and cover more people by providing more public programs or patchwork other systems or subsidizing their coverage somewhere else. That's how we're going to try and patch it. And they claim that out of 340,000 Minnesotans without any health care coverage at this time, they claim that they think 40,000 more people will get coverage because of what we did this year. And I have a feeling they're probably right. They'll get basic coverage, not dental care, not prescriptions, so they may not be able to use it all, but 40,000 out of 340,000 will have healthcare after this. We also have this trend where businesses are cutting back on it and healthcare is getting more expensive, and I think we're actually losing ground. And I think if they want exactly what they wanted, their proposal took effect, I think 10 years from now we have more people uninsured than we do now. So what's going to happen? There's a growing number of advocacy groups, growing number of medical providers who like our proposal. We've got more than a third of our legislature, more than a fourth, it's about a third, maybe it is more than a third now, of our legislature co-authoring the bill. It's a significant number of people. Unfortunately, it doesn't include legislative leadership of either party or the governor, and so we're working at changing that. We've got a bipartisan coalition of people trying to build a campaign to pass the bill over 3 or 4 years. And I describe it as almost a clash of cosmic forces coming up. It's going to come up in Minnesota, we hope in 3 years or so with this bill. It's going to happen around the country because the system is falling apart. Trying to get coverage, get a system that works for everyone, is an almost insurmountable barrier. We're not even seeing any of the opposition yet. No TV ads, that's going to be, they won't touch anything about it. They won't even talk about it until it's clear there's momentum for it. We passed out of one committee this year with a bipartisan vote. That was where it died. If we start passing through multiple committees, and it looks like it might pass, and the governor might sign it, then you'll start seeing a whole wall, a tidal wave coming against us of opposition with media advertising and everything else, which means there's no chance of passing it except for the fact that the system is falling apart at a rate that middle America is finding out they need some change, and they desperately need some change, and they see what's wrong with the system. And despite their fear, we are convinced that we can build a tidal wave in our direction, and then you've got a big clash of forces, and we're hoping it will change. Before opening it up for discussion, one of the obvious questions we get is, what about partial steps? It's such a big effort, why don't you try partial steps? I'd love to have partial steps and incremental change. If somebody has some suggestions, I will certainly welcome them. I've been in the legislature 22 years, and I've seen more than that number of years of tinkering with what we've got. Partial steps, oh, we're getting closer, because we now have 93% of Minnesotans with some coverage. Most Minnesotans wouldn't believe that, but we do have 93%. We have some basic public or private health care. They think that we're gaining, though it used to be higher than that. And they think this year we might raise it up to 94%. But you can't get there that way because you always have a patchwork. You always have people who are just laid off, people who were fired from their job, people who got a divorce, people who one reason or another didn't have it, and you're going to have people who don't have the benefits. So you can't tinker with it, and we're slipping further away from it. But I'd welcome if somebody has a proposal. We've been looking at ways to try and do a partial steps. Alternatives, again, I'm going to try in the next year, try what I tried last year, and that is reinstating our Healthcare Access Commission, this time explicitly telling them to look at our kind of approach, look at their kind of approach, have them each design a system that will deliver healthcare to 100% of the population for all their medical needs or a full range of services, and measure it against these criteria. I think our plan will get there. If theirs does, more power to them. I'd be glad to support it. If you're interested in more information, I can give you more later. There's a website we have promoting the bill. But with that, I think that should be enough fodder for discussion. And that includes things that you think are obviously wrong with the plan, because we've been hearing a lot of criticism and concerns, and we respond to them as we get them. So I like to hear them because I want to know if we're missing something. Why don't we start over here?
Yeah, one of the issues regarding, and I think it's a wonderful plan, sounds great, but one of the issues, one of the thesis of it is that other countries can do it, why can't we do it? Well, one of the drivers for the increase in health care in the United States also is litigation.
Litigation.
I mean, there are providers that are paying hundreds of thousands of dollars in malpractice insurance and practicing defensive medicine, and other countries just don't practice in the same aura of litigation. And so do you have some sort of a plan for dealing with litigation referral to malpractice?
Right. I mentioned briefly two of the ways that I think we are addressing it, but I don't know that that will solve it. I do think that that will help it a lot, and I do think we do have to find a way to address it. Right now, our country, for good or for bad, and usually for bad, we use our court system to try and compensate people for harm. One of the reasons people need large settlements now is there are people, when the bridge collapsed in Minneapolis last year, the maximum you could sue the state for, and it's the state's fault, the maximum you could sue the state for was, I think, $300,000 per person, and a cap on liability of $1 million for everyone per incident. And there was one bridge that fell, a handful of people died, lots more in very serious injuries, and a lot of them will have hundreds of thousands of dollars of injuries, and some of them with a lot of things. If you have traumatic brain injury, it could be a couple $1 million in a lifetime. you need that because we don't have any other way of paying for the healthcare. If we provide it through the system, you don't need it that way. Again, the other thing is people, juries, I think it's way overstated the harm, the cost of it, to in terms of payments. But the premiums, the insurance companies charge a fortune for the premiums, and doctors, as you said, do practice defensive medicine, which adds a lot of cost. And so I absolutely convinced by getting rid of the sense that we're going to punish an insurance company who's ripping us off, will help avoid excessive jury awards. If that's not enough, there are other ways I think we could try and do it, but I'm very open because we need to do something about the issue.
John, does your proposal negate the need for any private insurance at all?
Yes, for any of these, we actually prohibit sale of insurance for these services that are covered by this. There's some things that are not covered. Private hospital room, unless it's medically necessary, which it sometimes is. Cosmetic surgery is not covered, and except we already require it for reconstruction, breast cancer reconstruction, for port wine stain. There are certain things, cosmetic, so-called cosmetic surgery, are covered. Under current law, we continue those, but there are certain things like that that are not covered. The reason we would not allow people to sell insurance supplemental to it is because then you start getting what Canada and some other countries are getting. You get two tiers of health care. You get a plan, and then you get some supplemental coverage, and I'll get back to you in a second. But I think the best way you guarantee a good health care system is to make sure that the people who have the power have the same quality care you get, because they're not going to drop down to your level. You're going to go up to their level. Under our plan, the governor, every legislator, every corporate leader, including Bill McGuire, the guy who made $100 million a year at United Health Group, they'd all be covered under the same plan. It's going to be a good plan that way. So I think that's key. But go ahead, you want to follow.
The reason I asked, using myself as an example, I'm a retired AT&T Lucent person, and I have wonderful medical, dental. I don't pay a nickel for it. So I guess, where's my incentive for supporting the? I do. But I think there's a lot of people like me who would look at it that way.
Yeah, that's very true. There are people who would not benefit from it, other than they'd have a more logical healthcare system and more focus on prevention. But the biggest benefit would be family and friends who are struggling with the system. But you're right. If you have wonderful quality health care and you're not paying a nickel for it, this won't help you. Go ahead.
You said the plan was to provide all necessary health care. Who defines necessary health care?
Sure. That's a very good question, because it's not hard in terms of we spell out things that are covered, which
well,
is
it's hard now.
Which is, I understand. Well, let me get to the hard part. The simple part is there's 1,000 different things that are covered now. They're all covered. We spell out that it includes dental care. We spell out 1,000 different things it covers. Not 1,000, it's actually, I think, in the bill about 40 different types of things, but they're very broad. The questions where it becomes the tough issue becomes in experimental surgery, new things, which right now, depending on the health plan, if they don't want to cover something, they call it experimental. And until something passes that stage, that's the issue. We would have under this one, there is a planning board in there. This is through a democratically elected type of board, not direct election of people running statewide for this thing, but it comes up through county boards, elected by county. But they would be selecting a committee. These elected officials would select a committee to make those judgments in terms of when their medicine is new, experimental, whatever. You have to remember, again, everybody's in the system, including those members and so on. It's not an easy thing. We do the same thing now on those tough issues.
How does that simplify the bureaucracy of your new system when, as you know, and you just gave an example of three different ways to treat something that may be acceptable in a community depending upon some variation in what your disease process is? There may be three or four acceptable ways to fix that. And who determines that this new titanium implant is not acceptable because it costs twice as much as the stainless steel implant that you used 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Who makes that decision?
In this case, the decision is would be made by the doctor-patient relationship. And sometimes people will choose more expensive. Most times people would prefer
always they will.
The better quality. Mm-hmm. You save a ton of money by negotiating more appropriately. insulin injections, I mean, the price that people with diabetes pay for that is higher than it would be if you're a hospital, you pay a lot less for it.
What about if you wanted an insulin pump?
What?
What if you wanted an insulin pump? It's an implant.
Yeah. The issues in terms of what counts and so on, the starting point is that something is covered if it's a medical.
Well, I think your system is wonderful. It has great merit because it covers. I mean, who can disagree with what you're saying? But in the practical world, I don't see how that's going to solve or simplify the bureaucracy of providing this coverage unless you have a universal requirement everybody has to join.
Yes, it is.
It meshes with Medicare so that Medicare rules apply. Fee schedules applying for Medicare apply to your system. There's lots of hurdles that I see that are
Let me say with Medicare and Medicaid, this plan, like most of the reforms we're talking about in Minnesota and other states, require federal waivers. What we would be asking to do would be to fold Medicaid and Medicare into this. We collect the same, not inflation adjusted, but Medicaid and Medicare cost inflation adjusted, so we keep getting the same portion that we get now of the federal dollars, and it would all be folded into it. It'd be a single system, it would be part of it. That's the plan. If we can't do that, federal government won't give us waivers for some, we have to exclude some. The whole point of it is to put everybody in the same plan. That's where the savings come from. Yes, there would still be decisions you have to make in terms of that, and if there is a problem in terms of a particular titanium versus stainless steel, that's some of those things are going to be wrestled with, and the same way they are wrestled with now. It's a difficult thing in making a decision in each of those cases, but that's not the bureaucracy, that's the medical decision making and the system setting up the rules for it. So setting up rules once is a lot simpler than what we have now, where we have 50 companies set up the rules for it, and each company has to do it, and each doctor has to check with the company, depending on the person. It's not easy. I mean, I'm not suggesting it's not going to eliminate all problems. It's not going to eliminate expense. I think will still be the most expensive healthcare system in the world. I think it'll be cheaper than we have now. I'm giving too long of answers. I'll try, but keep coming back with follow-ups if you're.
I actually have a few questions. I mean, I am a medical student, and my main hospital right now is LA County Hospital, so we deal with a lot of people who are uninsured, and I think that your plan sounds great. I just really worry about logistics and how that would be done. I guess three comments I have is that the first one, kind of bouncing off what he had to say, is what would be covered and what's not, because I know, like, at LA County Hospital, all of our patients pretty much are federally supported or paid for federally and by the state, and a lot of stuff isn't covered, and I wonder if, like, all of our health care would go down to that level. For instance, we do not do any transplants at LA County Hospital because it's just too expensive. So if you're getting programs that are being paid by, like, a state or government, how much would our health care go down in order to provide basic services to everyone? The second one is I worry also, being a medical student, when I hear you saying, like, if we need more of this kind of doctor, we're just going to, you know, funnel people in that direction. So it really takes out a lot of, like, the choice that you have when you go into a profession. If you really feel called to do something and you feel like you have the skills to do something, being told that you can't do that because this is what the public needs right now. And I understand, like, you want to work with the public needs, but at the same time, you know, people go in because they want a choice. They want to be able to practice certain things, and they might be better at it. So just to say, well, we don't need as many, kidney doctors right now. We don't need any renal doctors, and because we need more general doctors, that kind of, I don't know, for me, I think that sucks. And then the third thing is I want to know, like, how it would be paid for. Because I know you're saying really generally, you know, everyone's premiums and businesses would be paying for this. But I know in California, a few proposals have been, I mean, which haven't passed, but, you know, they've been like, oh, well, some people don't mind taxes, but a lot of the general public do mind taxes. And so instead of making big tax increases, they were going to use, instead of giving tax rebates back, they were going to use that for some of it. But basically all of the extra chunk would be coming directly from doctors. So doctors were the ones who were going to suck up the bill. And it's already really hard if you're, you know, if you want to provide care to lower income people, which I guess this would be different, but you know, how do you provide that care when you're not getting reimbursed enough to keep the lights on in the building?
Okay, several things. One, if you recall the principles, which are requirements of the system, the prompt payment and responsible payment of providers is covered, period. You are paid for what you do. Mm-hmm. Number two, what about the level of quality going down? First of all, as I said, we have a lot of things explicitly covered. Transplants are explicitly covered under this. Would it go down to that level of care? That's the whole point of having everybody in the same system. George Bush vetoed the Children's Health Security Plan a number of months ago, and he criticized it as government health care, and he said that kids deserve better than that. The person who I know, if you look at George Bush, where he gets his health care, I think you couldn't say anybody gets more government health care than George Bush does. I think most kids would be happy to have his government health care. And the whole point is, George Bush isn't going to want to do without, nor are corporate leaders, nor are anybody else. We put everybody, every doctor, everybody's in the same plan, and we as a society don't want it. That's what I'm saying. We would be more expensive system than other countries. We wouldn't be double as much, I'd argue, but we would be more expensive than other countries, and it would not be dropping down to that level. The plan is prohibited from dropping below, I mean, the list of items covered, and I can give you a link to the bill if you want. In terms of kidney doctors, or renal doctors, you said, what if you want to do that and you're not able to? A couple comments on that. First of all, I think what the health plan is supposed to do is make sure there are enough providers everywhere. And the shortage is not of renal doctors, as far as I know. Maybe that is a shortage.
You just
said an example.
Just
I know.
Saying, like, what if you want to go in and one thing that's a specialty, but you're saying we need more general practice doctors, and what if you really feel like you want to do that and you really enjoy it and you can't do it because you're just doing a general
The health plan is not telling you can't do that. What the health plan would be doing would be using financial incentives. It would be paying more. We have differentials in pricing between urban areas in Minnesota and greater Minnesota. We have differentials in pricing. It usually means you pay less to practice in small communities. Very, very few general practitioners would prefer to be in a small town where they're on call every night, every weekend, all the time. They'd rather be in a big practice in the metro area where they can go home at the end of the day and they're done. And they're paid more to do that now. You pay more. The system is negotiating rates in every community. You pay more in the smaller communities. And one of the reasons, the biggest reason, med students will say it too, one of the reasons that more and more, a lot more students now are going into specialties than that is because they're compensated far better than general practitioners. Far better. You compensate it the right way, you make sure a school opens up enough slots in its school for general practitioners, and you know, right now if med schools have limited enrollment, and if they have too many people in a certain program, you're not going to be one if somebody else beats you out on it. And so it's not saying you can't do one or another. You'd still be able to do your specialty. You might not be paid as much, and certainly not as much more, than a general practitioner would be to do the specialty. If you love it, you'd be able to do it. You won't get the benefit from it. The third thing you said, taxes, how people pay for it. Yes, Americans hate taxes. We explicitly treat ours as premiums, as something that doesn't go to government. They'd be very high. Remember, we're spending $7,000 a year per person on healthcare in this country. a lot of that, almost half of it's already paid through government, through Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, public employees coverage, all the other things that fit in there. About half of our payments are already through government. This would all be replacing that and everything else with premiums, not going to the government, but going to the health plan, set by the health plan, not set by the government, not takeable by the government. And yes, opponents would say, oh, that's still taxes. They can call it taxes. What I pay for my health care, I call premiums.
It's just a form of insurance.
Yes, pardon?
It's just a form of insurance. It's just going into a public insurance.
Right, like Social Security. We all pay into it. Some people are paying more than they're going to get out of it. If somebody survived a disability, survivor benefits under Social Security, is purely an insurance function. And yes, this would be doing, we're all figuring out what our costs as a society are for health care. We're delivering it, and we're doing it the most efficient way we can.
Question?
Yes, go ahead.
I love what you're saying. I'm curious why business people aren't beating down your door. I mean, why are they not wanting to get out from the burden of covering their employees?
That's a good question. Why is business not beating down our door on this? First of all, there are a number of generally small businesses who are coming around this way. There was an article in the New York Times a few months ago about how businesses are really shifting on healthcare. Walmart actually had a news conference in Washington with Service Employees International Union about support for universal healthcare. Not very far along on specifics, and I would guess this isn't the thing Minnesota Chamber of Commerce or the U.S. Chamber of Commerce think. This is what we want. I'll guarantee it's not. But businesses are, they're going bankrupt on this. I mean, usually the way they do it is they cut their employees off from benefits, make them pay more, drop it all together. And they acknowledge, I mean, most businesses realize we're losing business. The automakers are a perfect example. People aren't building auto manufacturing plants in this country. They picked Windsor, Ontario instead of Detroit because the health care they estimate is about $1,400 to $1,500 of a tax we put on every car we manufacture in this country. That's like putting a tariff on your own cars even when you sell them in your own country. So employers are beginning to get that way. Why is the Chamber of Commerce and business leadership? Philosophically, they didn't want government to be involved in it. They see governments involved very heavily. But the Chamber of Commerce, at least the Minnesota Chamber, which I'm familiar with, they've got members who are health plans. You got members who are pharmaceutical plants. They don't step on any of their members. If 90% of their members would do better and 10% would be hurt and oppose it, they will oppose it. That's just the way they've been. But we're finding, I'm actually planning to speak to a number of local chambers of commerce because especially in greater Minnesota, they're hurting. So I think it's a real good question why they're not. We're working on it.
John, Minnesota was a leader in HMOs in the early 80s, and it didn't work very well. A lot of this sounds like an HMO. Could you speak to why
sure.
an HMO unit, why that movement failed?
Sure.
And yet we see places like Kaiser Permanente who provide good care, have good doctors, have high patient satisfaction. Why do they work, and why don't more people
One of the biggest problems with HMOs, I don't know how many of you saw the movie, the Michael Moore movie, Sicko. he's pretty harsh on HMOs, and this plan wouldn't have any HMOs. One of the harshest criticisms with HMOs are they're paid on a capitated basis. Per capita, if they have 10,000 members, they're paid for 10,000 members, a fixed amount. Their incentive is not to provide care anymore, it's to deny care. And that's one of the issues Michael Moore focuses on, lots of others have focused on. That's one issue, and this is not, this does not ban all use of that, but the health plan, by explicitly saying you cannot deny care, you couldn't function that way. You can't pay a provider on a capitated basis if it's going to hurt the care. The other way this saves money and works where HMOs don't is HMOs have a segment of the population. And every doctor still has to deal with 50 or 100 different payers, and each one of them for the same procedure, they pay different amounts to different plans for the same procedure, they have different co-pays, different things are excluded, different things are covered. You have the fixed system for everyone. I think it beats HMOs hands down. I have problems with the HMOs. The concept behind them was a great one. The idea that they deliver good health care is not there. Here, we got a lot of them quickly, and we got about 2 minutes. So I will continue this, and we can just stay here if you want. I know dinner has started, but we'll take two more, and then we'll cut it off, and people can stay seated if they want to ask more questions or whatever. So, Stacey.
Just a comment. I've worked at three different children's hospitals. I won't name the hospitals in specific, but last summer at this time, the one particular hospital I was working at tries to keep their uninsured level at a children's hospital under 46%, and we were at 56% uninsured, which I guess just a comment one would to say what our concerns are. If I have my health care covered, why should I be concerned? I'm scared for our next generation if we don't care for these children, and it broke my heart when the SCHIP did not go through. But I'm seeing families having to make very difficult decisions these days, and I hope that I'm very interested in your program, but I hope that that children are remembered in it through and through.
Yeah, and his point was, he says he's willing to
exactly.
Do it.
Yes.
And the point is, I think there are lots of people who are willing to do that. Some doctors would be paid less. I admit that some would be paid more, but a lot would be paid less. But I don't think doctors are functioning. I don't think they go to med school just because they think they can make a lot of money. I think they want to serve people too, and I've heard from doctors, and you can take polls of doctors, and they'll say, we're willing to cut back this if we can, one, practice medicine again, and two, we can make life better for people. Yes, that's our goal. So I think there's a lot more support for it than, the public is willing to do a lot more than people think. Take the last one, and then you can stay in your seats if you want, but you won't be walking out on us if you leave. So.
John, you said that we have the most expensive system in the world. You said that there's plenty of money in the system. That speaks to how profitable medicine is. Corporate greed is alive and well, and the pushback that you're getting is because of corporate and personal greed. We have not addressed that. They don't want to give up the power. What insurance company is structured to lose money? They got guys sitting back there predicting how they make money. I believe that we have a spiritual crisis. And the spiritual crisis is where greed has gotten us, personally and corporately.
And we're counting on people to feel that we need change, and because it's... As I acknowledge, we haven't seen it, and we will have when we make progress, which we believe we will. I don't think leadership has a clue. We got a third of the legislature out.
How do you talk them out of giving up their power and their money?
The way they've controlled the system is through the political process, fighting change. They will continue to do that. The way you overcome that is to defeat them. simple task. It's like you asked me how you win an election. Get more votes than your opponent does. With that, I will thank you all for your attention. And if you want to stay seated, I'll ask you.
So all Minnesotans in your bill, does it include documented and undocumented immigrants?
Good question. Our bill covers all Minnesota residents. That would mean that the controversial issue then is, well, what about undocumented people? And they are resident. If they're residents in Minnesota, they would be covered. You know, the best argument I can give, because it's highly unpopular, and we're very clear about that, but the thing is, if you've got an undocumented kid in your kid's classroom who has TB, you don't want them. You want them to be treated. You don't want communicable diseases spreading. And the other way is you have to set up a whole system. Are you qualified? A big part of our administrative cost is checking and checking and checking to make sure they count. Yes. Yeah. MNHealthPlan.org.
What is the website?
MNHealthPlan, like MNHealthPlan.org.
Sure. Question.
Yes. I have a question. If you're going to have more doctors and provide more services, is there some means of helping to finance the education of these people.
Good question.
At this point,
you know,
but somebody who's interested in it.
She's spending $60,000 a year.
Oh, it's absolutely.
$75,000.
And you end up with massive debt, which is another reason people want to go into specialties. We can make more because,
so you can pay the debt.
Because the debt is so high. No, our plan, the assumption is there are two things about this. And again, this isn't all spelled out in the bill, but it is assumed that in making sure they get it, right now, the only way we as a society try and make sure we get practitioners in small communities is forgiveness of debt.
Yeah.
And that's better than nothing, but the assumption should be, in my mind, that we pay for much more of the medical school costs. We subsidize that in exchange for the fact that she may not be making as much money in the future if you have a good plan, and so you have to take care of the debt of people who have the debt, and you got to make sure others don't have that much debt.
Plus, we need to fund medical schools more so that there are more of them.
Yes, we also have a shortage.
Yeah,
yes.
So that we can have more.
But it's an absolute crisis. She didn't mention it, but I don't know how much you expect to end up in debt, but it'll be a lot.
300,000.
That's kind of intimidating when you get out of school to have a $300,000 debt.
In defense of specialists, though, I don't think everybody goes into a specialty because of the finances.
They
go into it because you don't live in a world today when you have your car worked on by someone who isn't a specialist.
Oh, right.
You don't have your knee fixed by someone who isn't a specialist. So every part of our technology and every part of our society is going away from a generalist to a specialist, and I think it's an irreversible trend.
Okay.
Yeah, but when you're looking at $450,000 a year as an interventional radiologist versus $100,000 as a general practitioner, that point up there about spiritual crisis and greed, that plays in hugely. And
the way what I'd say about your comment is you're exactly right. We're not going to get rid of specialists. We shouldn't. That would be declining our quality of care, which is one of the principles we're not about to do.
My point is, I think you're going to have more, but you need a different tier.
I think you'd have more in certain areas where there's shortages, like psychiatrists, but the biggest, we have a crisis in shortage of general practitioners, and if we have preventive
care. Maybe you need to redefine who provides that introductory level of care, whether it's a nurse practitioner, a physician's assistant, assistant in your dental office.
I agree.
Is prevented.
We are actually, the bill, I didn't get into lots of parts because of limited time, but we actually have a thing.
You're right. There's no reason that.
The more specialized the care, the more expensive it is.
Right.
Medicare's been
cheaper
for years. If you have good primary care with primary care physicians, it's cheaper, higher quality care. That's not publicized, but it's data that's.
It's true. And he also says advanced practice nurses or RNs or physician's assistants, others, can provide even more. So our bill actually has one of the things I didn't get into is the concept of care coordinators, where people would be primary care providers, which can be a nurse, it can be a chiropractor, it can, depending on what if I have a special, it can be a specialist, can be your care coordinator. If I have mental illness, it might be a psychiatrist who's the care coordinator. But the point is, we try and structure it so people get the care they need in the most logical way. We're not going to get rid of specialists. Percentage-wise, we need a lower percentage of them in some of them. Others, we need a higher percentage. But
John, give me your elevator speech, because I can see the commercials coming.
Yes.
You mentioned a number of times that the system is broke, nothing in this country works, but other industrialized countries do it. Everybody hears horror stories, of what happens, boy, if you get sick. I wouldn't want to be sick in Canada. I wouldn't want to be sick in Europe for anything, for an operation. I could see the commercials of the Sheikh of Jordan, flying the Mayo Clinic, because he would never have the operation in his country.
Right.
What's your elevator speech that says that, yes, they can do it, but? From all those commercials that are going to come that says, John Marty wants, universal haircare. Would you like to move to, Switzerland?
Right. And exactly. The point is they have the money to distort, because the reality is not such. I mean, you talk to people who got sick in England or sick in Germany, and they kind of like it. They're actually covered. In Norway, you're covered even if you're from here. You're traveling there, you get sick there, you do it. actually, the largest number of Canadians that getting medical care in the U.S. are people who got sick while on vacation or while traveling in the U.S. And the waiting lines issue, all those things, again, that's why we put explicitly in the plan prohibitions on delaying care, denying care, because we're going to get those. We're going to get those attacks. We're going to need push back the other way through advertising. Advertising will be part of it. But
I just have a response to that. I mean, part of it too is there are people dying here now.
I don't think it's just up to advertising.
Right. I think that's up to us.
Right. That's why we're organizing. That's why we've got a campaign to do it, to build that.
But I mean, it's really up to us to tell, to know the truth and tell the truth to our neighbors,
because they will.
To our
families. The other benefit of this plan, when Hillary Clinton came in with her plan in 1993, it was 1,300 pages long. It was attacked by a lot of people and a lot of commercials. Harry and Louise was it? It was attacked by that. She couldn't explain it to anyone. I mean, it was that big of a bill. I made a point when I presented my bill to my committee. This bill is 24 pages long, and you can read it and you can understand it. You can figure out what it means. In that system, the more complicated it is and the harder to explain it is, and it doesn't cover everyone, it doesn't cover everything, people are afraid, hey, I'm going to get worse off than I am. Right. So I think it is easier to explain, but you're right. I don't want to minimize at all the fact that I'm not predicting this is going to pass in 3 years from now. I'm hoping it is, and I'm fighting for it because I think it can.
John, I'm from Canada. I just want to jump in because I want to correct some misconceptions right now.
I don't think he has those misconceptions.
Okay. I don't have them. I was asking for the elevator.
But I want everybody here to know that we do have a two-tier system, and it's because of the same corporations that put pressure on our health dollars. And so our waiting lists get longer and longer. But if you need acute care, you get acute care, whether you're the prime minister or the person on welfare in the streets. And unfortunately, we don't have enough of the preventative care, because what's really clogging our hospital is drug addiction and alcoholism on almost all wards, clogging the hospitals. The prevention isn't there to look after them.
That's an excellent point, and that's one of the reasons. I mean, we explicitly spell out chemical dependency, mental health coverage, because it's one of the things that is breaking the bank here, too. It's filling our prisons. It's filling our hospitals. And what we're trying to learn from Canada and other countries is to address those specific things, like the waiting list things, and, again, the fact that their system is hurting for money. If you look at the frontline PBS show that you can get online, you look at what they talk about in Taiwan, actually all five countries they look at, every one of them they say that the system is short of money. Taiwan, the guy says they're spending 6.1% of their GDP, and the guy asks them, yeah, if you spent like 7% or so, yeah, we'd take care of our problems. They're underdoing it because the politicians are setting the costs, and they don't want to put enough money into it. That's why we're isolating it from state government, making it an independent health plan that has the power to set the premiums and the budgets.
Right, and we are paying less than you are.
Yeah. Oh, you're paying just over 50% of what we're paying. So,
what is the fate of the insurance companies right now? The Medicas, the Blue Cross.
What would happen to them? Mm-hmm. They would. A lot of them operate hospitals, operate clinics. They could still operate hospitals. Somebody has to administer hospitals, clinics. Of medical practices. They're not banned from doing that. They are banned from insuring people, in effect. So there would be loss of jobs there. I acknowledge that. That's one of the reasons they fight hard. They have employees that fight hard, and I don't want to minimize the fight. I'm just saying we don't have much choice because the system is crumbling. A guy who I talked to about 10 years ago told me, a physician for National Health Plan, guy in Minnesota, said that, he said, John, you know, I think we're going to get healthcare reform sooner than you think. So why? He said, I think the system's crumbling faster than we think. And it is. I mean, it's sad. But a few more, and then we'll quit. So, yeah.
I don't know if you looked at the Sheila Kuehl bill in California, but which got passed by a legislature and then vetoed by the governor. But it included training for the people who work for insurance companies who would need to get
retraining. Yeah. We actually started from that bill when we were going to put one in. I thought, oh, California got something moving. Let's copy it. We started there. It was 70 pages long when it was converted to our style system. And I was going to say, they got a lot more lawyers in California than they do in Minnesota, because it was a complicated thing. It's a lot better than what you got, but it was, I think we've made the bill, the proposal much better. But that was, California's one of the states where you actually started making real progress on something. It was close. And I think it had a lot of problems with the plan, but I think it was a step forward.
I understand that most people now are in favor of a single pay system, as well as most doctors.
Most doctors clearly are, and I think the public says they are actually, the public says they're willing to spend more money if everybody gets health care. As long as their quality doesn't go down, if everybody gets it, they're willing to spend more. We're not asking them to spend more, but we are asking people at the higher end would be spending more. Overall, the system's cheaper, but yeah.
Why three years?
Mm-hmm. 3-4 years.
Precisely.
We have a new governor at that time. It's just going to take that long, and I'll be thrilled. I think there'll be thousands. There'll be millions of Minnesotans thrilled if we get there. The best analogy I can give to how these things do pass: Switzerland was a similar system to ours. 13, 14, 15 years ago, the PBS show talks about, the Frontline show shows this, and they had a national referendum on it, and it squeaked by, I don't know if it's 50.5% or 51, 52%, narrowly, highly contested fight, and the current president of Switzerland, I think it's president, was interviewed on the PBS special, and he talked about how his party had strongly opposed it at the time, but does he oppose it? Oh, no, nobody opposes it. It's accepted. Everybody likes it. That's not saying it doesn't have problems. People die. I mean, the healthcare system doesn't solve every problem, and it shouldn't be seen as that way. But in terms of whether they'd go back to what they had, no. He said no support anywhere. And his party was the one fighting against it. Mm-hmm. Any last ones?
I'm just curious, the cost of the system would obviously be based on how much care has to be given, or
right.
given out. And I think one of the unfortunate things is our country is headed in the, more and more people are overweight and obese. And you've obviously stated
and
that you
it's
want to,
aging population.
Yeah, you want to go from a treatment-based system to a prevention-based system. I'm just curious, what are some ways to that you
would... Okay. I'll give the 1-minute answer instead of the 10-minute answer. But a whole range of things from requiring the plan, we have a specific budget for public health. It's not doctors telling people to lose weight and do it. That's a very expensive way to do it, and it's not the best way to do it. Working to make sure our schools, we don't have physical education as a requirement in Minnesota anymore. Making sure you have good public health initiatives, making sure you actually promote it. Anti-smoking ads in California had a tremendous impact on reducing the number of smokers. That crisis that you point out is very much why the system, which is going up at 3 times the rate of inflation now, is going to continue to do that. We can't possibly make it as a society unless we do the prevention. I don't care what system you got, you got to have prevention, or we're sinking. And that chemical dependency is a big part of that, mental health, obesity. You name it. Those are the issues that are driving our healthcare dollars. Are there any last ones? If not, I very much appreciate your attention and
thank you.
Happy to talk with you more during the coming days. So.